The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, but the best part is that Sparkplug custom roasts this exceptional coffee within 1 week of delivering it to you anywhere in the US and Canada so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order a spark plug as you need it, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. There's no commitment, and it's completely flexible. And because you're a top 100 listener, Sparkplug is giving you 20% off your next coffee order. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Let's go on a coffee spree. It's so much better than a shooting spree.
Why doesn't the Second Amendment just protect your right to have fresh, fair trade coffee?
Caffeine for all, guns for fewer.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi-ho, fans of the flicks, and thanks for striking the play button on the 425th Ellis's Analysis here on the Top 100 Project. We review movie classics every Monday morning, and we spoil them from stem to stern. I'm the Canadian who does lock his front door pretty much all the time. Michael Moore, you're making that up. That's just out of your ass.
I cherry-picked.
Ryan Ellis. And here's the expert bowler who enjoyed shooting guns in Vegas a few years ago, but I don't think she'd want to aim them at anybody. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
Would you?
Oh, I'll never shoot a gun again. I didn't really enjoy it.
I thought you did more than I did. I thought it was okay.
I wanted to do it way more than you did. But I was shocked at the loudness of it and, I don't know, the gravity of it all. I'm really glad that we did it. I'm really glad I got to experience it. We have friends who've done the same thing and loved it and are like, oh, I totally get it now. No, I get it even less.
I remember the story that James Cameron supposedly told about Sigourney Weaver. Took her to a shooting range before Aliens and this liberal person. Yeah, that was awesome, Jim. Well, that was us in a way. James Cameron was your imagination. We were Sigourney Weaver, but our response was, no, did it once. That's enough. I either missed the target entirely or I was a decent shot. So that means I'm not a very good shot. And I don't want to be hurting anybody or hitting anybody or killing anybody anyway, especially when I'm not even that good at it. Okay, some notes right off the top before we get into Bowling for Columbine. Although we're big fans of this movie and we like Michael Moore a lot, we know who we're dealing with. He likes to play fast and loose with facts, including the locking the doors here in Canada thing, especially when he goes to Toronto, and we lock the doors especially in a bigger city, like any city would.
Okay, but it's not like he planted those houses. He really did find these houses.
I wonder if he did. That'd be so easy to set that up.
There was a campaign where he said that anybody who could genuinely dispute a fact, it was either in this movie, maybe it was in Fahrenheit 9/11. It was $10,000 for somebody who could prove something wrong.
That's
he was so
movie.
Thorough about fact-checking. That's okay, fair enough.
So we'll call this movie out when we know or strongly suspect his facts are not accurate. And I think that's one of them right there. Also, I re-listened to our Fahrenheit 9/11 episode, and I was shrill. I don't retract anything I said. If anything, I feel stronger about hating Trump and Bush and their superfans, especially Trump and his superfans. I'm just going to try not to yell and scream too much this time. Okay, the coming attractions trivia question for Bowling for Columbine, an easy one to find if you have YouTube, and who doesn't? During Michael Moore's Oscar acceptance speech, he mentions some people at the very end of the speech when he says about George W. Bush, anytime you've got blank and blank against you, your time is up, and your time is up, Mr. Bush. Who was he talking about?
Okay, I didn't look this up. Was one of them the Dalai Lama?
No, but not a far-off guess.
Okay, who is it?
Anytime you've got the Pope and the Dixie Chicks against you, your time is up.
Oh, I really meant to go back and rewatch that, and then I forgot to, because that Oscar speech was one of the most controversial moments to ever happen in Oscar history. Now, the Oscars won't admit it, and they'll never revisit it. It's never going to end up on a highlights reel. But it's up there with La La Land, I mean Moonlight, of one of the craziest things that's ever happened at the Oscars.
Before we talk about that, I'll make this little point about the Dixie Chicks and Michael Moore. The Chicks suffered after their own innocuous comment in England. We're not very proud of the presidents from Texas. Boo! How dare they say that about... This is back before things got really crazy in America. So the backlash against them was way worse than Michael Moore got for what he said at the Oscars, which was way more incendiary than what they said, which was, not that proud, the president's from our state.
They were coming from a really different place. Michael Moore was always this leftist blowhard. The same way that Trey Parker and Matt Stone just always get away with saying things, or like Howard Stern. There's certain people that are kind of grandfathered in to this persona that they've had for so many years that people expected from them. Whereas the Dixie Chicks, or the Chicks I should say, they were country stars. They were...
Bush's people, red, they would have
yes,
thought.
Yes, they were red state country artists. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, they've gone deeper and dug deeper into being left-wing country artists. I don't know what that has translated into for their radio play, but I think...
A lot less.
A lot less, but at the same time, they've gotten picked up by pop music. The left has embraced them, because it's not like people who are in the left wing don't like country music.
I barely knew anything about them when that happened, and I started following... Well, I saw the documentary, Shut Up and Sing, in 2006, which I loved also.
Great documentary.
So emotional and so truthful. And that was before things, as I said, got so crazy in that country the way they are now. So Moore won the Oscar for Best Documentary along with Michael Donovan and Kathleen Glynn, his then wife. They're now divorced. I think they all got Oscars, but Moore and Donovan definitely did. So he gets a standing ovation. And when Diane Lane announces it, she seemed, yeah, of course, it's got to be Bowling for Columbine. Scorsese stands up. Everybody did that was there that night. But then when he starts getting political, all these people have these looks on their faces like, oh, don't go there, Mike. But apparently Moore did the exact same speech at the Independent Spirit Awards the night before and got a standing ovation from those people, some of which would have been at the show at the Oscars the very next day.
This is such a great example of how people value, quote, civility, and that they just want even the most radical, vocal people to toe the company line when they perceive that it matters. Michael Moore could care less about the Oscars. He's not in this to win an Oscar. He truly is, and people could dispute this, but I really do believe he wants to change the world because he wants to help people. Because he wants fewer people to die in gun violence. He wants fewer soldiers to die in a pointless war. He's like, great, an Oscar. All the Oscar was going to do was probably make it a little bit easier for him to fundraise his next project.
Hence, Fahrenheit 9/11.
But, yeah, he wasn't going to have any trouble fundraising his next project because Bowling for Columbine was a phenomenon. This guy was funding projects back when documentaries were counted on not to make money. None of them ever made money. I think Roger Me did pretty well, all things considered. That was a phenomenon.
The Big One did pretty well.
Big One, yeah, that's right.
But by documentary standards.
By documentary standards, whereas Bowling for Columbine set a new standard for what documentaries could accomplish as far as box office goes. And it was a high budget. It was a $4 million film. But he did not care about winning an Oscar. Maybe he did, but trust me, he cared way more about his message getting out to all the people who were watching the Oscars than he did about taking home that trophy, which he still got to keep, even though they kicked him out. They apparently not so graciously escorted him out the back door, and he was not allowed back in after that speech.
I love the touch he brings up the other Best Documentary nominees, and he honors Michael Donovan from Canada, because, of course, Canada is a fairly big part of this movie, really. And then it gets into, I brought them up because we like nonfiction. We're documentary filmmakers, and this is a fictitious time, and this is a fictitious present, and that's when it got controversial. But he brought them up there, which I don't think anyone else has ever done willingly, which is, let's all share this. Yes, I get to take the award, and I'm going to speak, but let's all share this. Has that ever happened before? And the other great part about it, because I didn't know this was true until fairly recently, and even now, he's not exactly vocal the way so many actors are. Harrison Ford, they cut to a wide shot, you see Denzel Washington, Harrison Ford, Clissa Flockhart, of course. I think you see Ed Harris and Amy Madigan as well. But Ford is grinning ear to ear, and apparently he's a big lefty, so it makes sense that he would be. And I think the whole thing there is, you get him, Mike. So even though there was booing, that may not have been the actors, that may have been the people upstairs, because there's a lot of people at the Oscars who aren't the celebrities, right? And Moore getting booed may have been other people. It may have been 5, 10 people, and it just seemed like it was more than it really was, probably more than 5 or 10. But anyway, I always remember those two things. He brings up the other nominees on stage, which was a really classy thing to do, and Harrison Ford's enormous grin.
You know, you talk about how everybody was okay with his speech at the Spirit Awards. Well, the Spirit Awards aren't televised, so they can cheer him on and they can agree with him in private. But once it's in public and they're on television,
they want to keep working.
I kind of get it. When you're at this echelon of Hollywood and maybe you're Harrison Ford and you're so successful and you could give a damn if this hurts your career because you got caught grinning at his speech. But if you're more of an up-and-comer or even an A-lister that doesn't want what happened to the Dixie Chicks to happen to you.
Which came later, I believe.
It came later. It hadn't happened yet. I don't think we were eating freedom fries yet at this point.
Okay, well, we'll get back into the conversation, but let me set everything up by saying Gun Nuts was screened at many festivals, then was released by UA and MGM and many other production companies 20 years ago in October and November of 2002. It hauled in nearly 15 times its budget. 15. So you could say this started the Fahrenheit 9/11 March of the Penguins run, where documentaries started making bank and serious money. Not just, okay, we broke even or we didn't quite lose the money that most documentaries do. No, we can be a business. And they became that.
They started getting funding too. Documentaries got a lot better. This ushered in a golden age for documentaries.
Super Size Me, I believe, was the Fahrenheit 9/11 year. And that was also pretty successful.
Yes.
By documentary standards. Okay, well, please remind us what the movie's about, Bev, with the Bowling for Columbine. Skitty.
Back in 2002, Michael Moore sought to get to the bottom of gun violence in America, a problem that had been brought into sharp focus when, in 1999, two teenagers carried out one of the most prolific mass shootings in American history
at the time
at Columbine High School. Back in 99, it was. It's still pretty prolific. What made them do it? Was it video games? Was it Marilyn Manson? Or was it their elective bowling class?
Which apparently they didn't do. That day.
They did bowl, but they didn't that morning. Mm-hmm. 6 a.m. too.
What Moore implies that they did. So again, that's one of those.
But
that a fact?
That wasn't his fault. That was actually misreported. A lot of things about Columbine were misreported. I read this really excellent book about Columbine, a really deep journalistic dive into what actually happened and then how the media misconstrued.
What? They did what? How
like,
could they?
The notion of the trench coat mafia, it wasn't really like that. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, they weren't the most popular kids in school, but they weren't outcasts either. I think Eric Harris had a girlfriend. He was just a straight psychopath. He was just a bad person. Dylan Klebold was his little sidekick that got really sucked into it for teenager reasons. But one of the details that was dispelled was this notion that they belonged to the, quote, trench coat mafia.
But you could blame bowling, and you could blame video games. You could blame Marilyn Manson. You can blame, as he does in this movie, things like Clinton bombing Iraq that morning, an hour later saying, "You probably all heard that there's been a tragedy in Colorado today." An hour after, according to what Moore shows on screen, maybe that's not accurate either, but supposedly at least the same day, that he had bombed a country, which is what all presidents do. This isn't just a Clinton thing, not the Bushes, not just Obama, not Trump. Everyone does it because that's what American presidents do. Okay, in a nutshell, very simply, after Michael Moore says after opening a Canadian's door, we talked about this already, but thank you for not shooting me. I love that touch. I don't know if that really nutshells it, actually, but he doesn't get shot, and thank God for that. I think he's had to have security since at least this movie around him. I don't know if the Dixie Chicks ever had to have security around them all the time. At their shows, I think they did. And we said the Pope, right? The Pope's against you. Well, the Popemobile, that happened because Pope John Paul II, something like 40 years ago, was shot at. So he was driving around in that bulletproof glass thing forever. Okay, well, Rotten Tomatoes loves this movie, especially the critics. The audiences do too. But the critics, 95% of them on the site, gave it a positive review. 8.2 out of 10 was the average on the strength of 173 reviews. 83% of audiences, which is still pretty good. And these are the second best Rotten Tomatoes numbers in Michael Moore's career. Number one is, and we've already covered it, we've done three of his movies now, so you can guess what it is.
Fahrenheit 9/11.
No, it's Roger and Me. 9/11 is fairly polarizing. It's a fresh tomato.
Oh,
Roger and Me has 100%
of
critics.
Of course it's Roger and Me. Oh, as it deserves. That's maybe still his best film in a way.
And Sicko's way up there, too. I think, actually, Sicko might be the movie I like the most of all of his. It was 104th at the 2002 U.S. box office. Chicago, the Best Picture winner, was number 10. Another controversial moment of the night, because I think most people thought it was going to be, why am I forgetting it now? No, Pianist. It had won Best Director. It had won for the screenplay. It had won for Brody as Best Actor. But Chicago won. That was 10th. The Ring, we covered that a couple of years ago, was 18th horror film. This has got some horror in it. An Adaptation, this is comedic at times, that certainly is comedic, was 102nd. We already talked about the Oscar that it won. It also won the American Cinema Editors Award for documentaries. And documentaries sometimes get nominated for awards other than just Best Documentary. An Inconvenient Truth won for Best Song. And Hoop Dreams got nominated for its editing, but not for Best Documentary. But usually documentaries get nothing else other than the Best Documentary Award, or even nomination, and this maybe could have been nominated for its editing. And it also won the 55th Anniversary Prize at Cannes, and Moore won the Palme d'Or 2 years later with Fahrenheit 9/11. Okay, well, this is your, let's see, I don't have my calendar. I haven't got a calendar yet this year on the wall, so it would be your third movie this? Yes, your third movie so far in the month of Bev 2022. We know you like it because you picked it. We'll definitely have a connection with next week's movie, City of God with the Guns, But the connection from last week is the bullying of Don Wiener. Now we have the, well, you just said maybe not, but supposed bullying of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, leading them to shooting people and kids, in fact, in their school, including teachers. But what are your thoughts on bullying for Columbine?
Any longtime listener already knows that Michael Moore has a very special place in my heart. Not necessarily for his politics, which I mostly agree with, but for pioneering a style that really defined the marriage between political activism and comedy and documentary as well. But I think more so the irreverence that he brought to political activism. Without Michael Moore, without Roger and Me, and without TV Nation and The Awful Truth, I don't know that there would be The Daily Show. And without The Daily Show, I don't even know what the late night landscape would look like today. Michael Moore knew the exact spoonful of sugar he had to add to his medicine to absolutely galvanize a movement. It's a passionate movement and it's youthful. And then there's a way that this film in particular absolutely blew open the genre of documentary. The film was a hit, like you said. When I went to see it at a popular downtown movie theater, not an art house movie theater, I had to wait in line to see this movie. This has simply never happened for a documentary before. That is the kind of thing that happens for the new Star Wars film, not the new Michael Moore film. But it happened, and that would still be exceptional now. But in 2002, absolute game changer. It introduced so many people to the genre, and then within 5 to 10 years, documentaries went from being this little niche, arty, almost an act of charity to finance, to a real viable market.
You're speaking Hollywood's language now.
Well, that is true. And then the talent that we've seen come out of that market in the past 20 years, truly masterpieces that never would have gotten financing before. It's also an outstanding vehicle for activist messaging. This little film may not have had the impact it wanted to have on violence in America, but it really did change the world of cinema. I think there's lots of movies that have done it much better since, but that owe a huge debt to Michael Moore. I'm thinking of The Smartest Guy in the Room.
Enron, that's a documentary.
Enron, Smartest Guy in the Room.
That's a really good one.
It is such a great film. The Corporation, another great one. And one of my all-time favorites, Too Big to Fail. What an outstanding film that really had power over the public. So now that I've said all those really nice things, maybe looking through the lens of 20 years of great films that followed this film, Bowling for Columbine, it kind of benefited from a really low bar. It's a pretty messy film. Not in its message. I have no meaningful objection to the politics, but the execution is really sloppy.
I complimented the editing a few minutes ago, and I think technically it probably is worthy, but at the same point, it is a bit, I guess you just said, of a mess. We said that on Fahrenheit 9/11 quite a few years ago, and now that we've watched it again fairly recently, although it's been more than a week since we saw it, but we've both seen it many times, that feels even more true. And maybe the best example of that are the last two scenes, the last two sets of scenes. One of the best things he's ever done in any movie ever, and he's blown away that it worked. It was the stunt of taking two kids who were shot at Columbine to Kmart to try to get refunds for the bullets that are still inside their bodies. And what does Kmart do? I don't know if they lived up to it, but at the time they came out with a spokesperson and said, we will no longer sell bullets in Kmart. I think it was going to be months later they wouldn't keep doing it. So she does all that and she walks away, and then Michael turns back to the two kids and says, wow.
It's more than we asked for. That's what he said.
That's what it was. And basically saying, I never win when I do these kinds of things.
Yeah.
But it's followed up with the Charlton Heston thing, which is basically the end of the movie. I didn't like it then. I like it less now. I don't have any sympathy for Heston because it is that from my cold, dead hand.
He was the president of the NRA.
Regardless of a school shooting, that whole thing of from my cold, dead hand, he does fudge the facts a little bit, apparently, from when the timing was of them coming to Columbine or the Denver area, the Columbine area, to have a gun show. I don't think it was quite the short time period he implies, but whether it was or if it wasn't, it may be in bad taste, but they have a right to do that. My problem is not even that. My problem is that he is badgering somebody, and we didn't know at the time, but Heston probably had the Alzheimer's that I think he died of, but he definitely had Alzheimer's, they were saying, and dementia, those kinds of things. But even if that's not true, Heston's opinion is, well, we have a violent history. That's why there's so many gun deaths in America. Well, what about Germany? What about Russia? What about Japan? Well, okay, they have violent histories. That's Heston's opinion. Heston's allowed to be wrong. What do you want from the guy? Okay, he's the NRA head at that point, so maybe he has more to answer for, but he's allowed to be wrong. You pin your movie at the end on getting him. It's a pretty good get. And apparently they just found star maps, and that's how they found his place, because Moore was trying to get him to be interviewed long before that. But it just feels like this whole big after this really excellent scene where they actually won something. If that really happened with Kmart, and in the movie it says it did.
I don't feel one bit bad for Charlton Heston, no matter what the circumstances were. He's the president of the NRA at this time. There's no way that Michael Moore knew that he was suffering dementia, and it's not his obligation to be clairvoyant and understand that in the first place. The NRA has, before and since, shown a pretty bad track record of going to places after mass shootings and having rallies there. They deserve to be called out for that.
Well, you know now, why, Bev? One quick thing. Had a good guy with a gun been around, wouldn't have happened.
Which, of course, has been misproven many times. Like, yep. The NRA have just shown their ass so massively. 20 years ago, the NRA was not the laughingstock villain that they've become now. They were considered a respectable organization. So when Michael Moore does this, he's trying to pull the curtain back and show people, listen, the NRA, I know you think that they're just representing hunters or whatever, but there is actually something insidious behind this. I don't think he does a good job illustrating that, though. I don't think that scene is good. I'm defending his actions because I don't think he deserved criticism for what he did. But I'm not defending leaving that scene in the film at all. It doesn't cover any fresh ground. It actually just makes Michael Moore look bad because Charlton Heston seems like an old man who does not want any part of this.
He's also being polite at the very least.
He's trying to be polite. It just isn't the gotcha that he wanted to get. You didn't get the scene you wanted. I know you wanted this to be your big finale that you were going to hang your hat on. You didn't get it. I'm sorry. What you did get was this other incredible scene in Kmart that ends on such a ray of hope. It was such a mistake not to just end the film there with this huge moment of success, of optimism. End with a win. Why do you have to end the film looking like a big dumb jerk picking on this old man? You're not wrong about it. It just cinematically doesn't work.
I agree with all that.
And it takes all the energy down. You could have incorporated scenes from that in other places in the film where you're already kind of addressing things like the way the NRA is. But it just isn't the tentpole that he thinks it is at the end of the film. You were talking about the editing. I don't think it's a well-edited film. I think that Michael Moore has gotten a bit better about this, but this film, worse than any of his
it's
others,
flashily he cannot edited. Kill That's his why it's impressive. It's JFK flashiness, as in the Oliver Stone JFK movie, which is so flashy and also extremely long. So is that well edited? That's what I'm talking about.
That's not the problem I have with it.
Okay.
The problem I have with it is that it's all over the place.
That's true.
The film starts out being about Columbine and then takes this diversion into one silly story after another, whether it's getting a gun at the bank or a dog that shoots people by accident. And then it takes this diversion into live death, which... That is a choice to show people being killed in your movie. Kind of the way that he showed the bunny being killed in Roger and Me. Mm-hmm. That's a bunny, though. I don't like watching it. I think it really works in that film.
She's going to eat the thing. Huge,
she's going to eat the thing. Versus, without any warning, I had actually somehow completely forgotten that you really do watch people die on screen.
A lot of them, too.
A lot of people. And I don't think we should look away, but it's just the way that the movie shifts tone so dramatically. I'm not sure what that montage really accomplishes, more so than the security footage that they show of Columbine, which is more impactful. And then it diverts to foreign policy and American history. You gotta make up your mind. You picked a topic that is so meaty. You could have a great film where you just really focus on the gun issue or even just American violence, domestic violence. Not domestic in the sense of in families. Although, if you're being honest
about...
You
didn't get into that at all, but that's an issue too.
Well, actually, most gun deaths, I think suicides outnumber everything else pretty dramatically. And he doesn't get into that. He doesn't get into masculinity, which he said that's his biggest regret about the film, that he didn't really get into toxic masculinity and how that plays into the obsession with guns and violence and women don't do mass shootings. Not to say that women are innocent in all cases, but... That's just something that he fails to address, but instead he takes these big diversions about the CIA funding coups in other countries. It's just a different movie. I'm not saying it's not valid.
That's not
it's just
really
the wrong
about
movie.
Gun violence, especially about legal guns. The problem here isn't arms deals, Reagan's Iran-Contra thing, which is a scandal in its own right. He can make a movie about that for sure. Reagan should be blasted way more often than he ever has been. I've said this in a lot of podcasts. I'm not going to scream, but I've said it before. But that's really almost irrelevant. But then I guess he wants to set up the whole thing with Heston at the end, Why is it so bad here? Well, there's a lot of violence in other countries, but their gun deaths are not that bad, including in Canada. And Canada is probably the biggest foreign country that's actually in this movie, because he does literally come here, of course. It's also a theme, by the way. He goes overseas in Sicko. He goes overseas in, what's it called? Damn, the one
about... Capitalism Love Story?
Probably that, but no, it's another one he did. I can't think of the name of it right now. Why can't I think of the name of it? Where if they make a better wine, we drink it. If they make a better car, we drive it. Maybe it is that, where he goes overseas and sees how they live. Sicko definitely does that. So anyway, the point is that if you want to compare it to other countries, I can understand the logic, but this is about people that are buying guns legally. The great line, which apparently is disingenuous too, but I loved it. I had a picture of it on my wall before I met you for the longest time, cut out of Entertainment Weekly or something like that. Do you think it's a little dangerous handing out guns in a bank? It's so funny. It's so well set up. That's well timed and well edited. But apparently you don't just get a gun if you sign up. Yeah, you do see him going through the
sign-up sheet.
But it's not a matter of even doing that and then getting it once you've been approved that day. There's a whole process. That still is weird. It's still weird that there are guns on the wall. Canadians are always going to find that weird regardless. I don't think we really have that anywhere. Maybe somewhere in Alberta they're like that because they're our gun place. But even they're probably not commonly doing that everywhere. So yes, it's still strange, but they're legal guns. The most sympathetic scene in the whole movie from people holding a gun, and I can understand their logic a little more, if not a lot more even, is when he goes to the Michigan militia. The one guy who says, if you're not armed, you're not responsible. I don't agree with that entirely, but rural people. My parents lived out in the country for many years. My dad had a truck or something that he had stolen once. I think more than once stuff was stolen from them because they lived in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, you're
I understand
target.
More when you were to say, as the guy says in this movie, I think the woman actually says it, so you're being robbed or somebody's threatening you. What are you going to do, call the police? They're so far away if you live in the middle of nowhere. You can take care of yourself. I don't fully agree with the logic, but I can see that way more from people that live in the middle of nowhere. And that's really the story of this movie, is legal guns and people having stockpiles, which got way worse in the past 20 years. People like those Michigan militia guys, if they leaned right, they probably have, if they had then 20 guns, they probably have 50 now, or maybe even a lot more, and way worse types of weapons. And why? That's the movie he should have made.
Yeah.
I like the movie, but I'm judging him on that basis.
I feel like the stuff with the militia is some of the best stuff in the movie, mostly because he's not making fun of them. He lets them talk and he listens. And there's nothing that they say that I agree with, but at the same time,
they don't seem crazy,
don't come
though.
Across as crazy. And he just lets them get through their whole rationale for their lifestyles. I don't think they're bloodthirsty. I don't think they're racist. They don't even come across as gun nuts to me. I believe that they believe that they are doing this as patriots to be responsible. And I appreciate seeing their humanity. There's also this really beautiful scene that comes pretty soon after this where he's interviewing the home security expert. And he's going through the house, telling him all the features that this house has that makes you safer because Americans are terrified of the violence in their country. And then there's a moment, because it's in Columbine that he's talking to this guy, Columbine comes up and he starts talking about it and then he just unexpectedly chokes up. This is somebody that you kind of get the impression, oh, Michael Moore, he's going to make fun of this guy. He's going to totally make a joke about this. But instead he shows this really earnest empathy and he gives him time and space. And that moment where this guy who is so affected by the violence in his community, he's like a gruff middle-aged dude.
And it's been about 2 years at that point.
Yeah, and then he chokes up on camera. You can imagine how hard it must be for him if he's still feeling this way. And it's a similar moment later. There's a teacher who's very young children
now
in
her
class.
Now we're in Flint, though, for that.
In Flint, and one of her students accidentally killed another student in her class with a gun that he
brought to his class. Killed a girl. So a boy killed a girl.
Yeah, in the teacher's class. That's what I mean. Sorry.
Okay.
She also breaks down. He shows true empathy towards his subjects. I think this is the best thing he does when he's really emotionally connecting to people. And these are the moments that I believe, that make me believe that he really cares about what he's doing and his heart is in the right place. And sometimes he can make fun of people and it's really funny and they're villains and we get to laugh at them. Sometimes it falls flat, like the Charlton Heston thing. And then sometimes he gets to the bottom of someone's humanity. Oh, and then sometimes he does something so gutsy and crazy when he's interviewing... Oh, no, I've forgotten the guy's name, but the Timothy McVeigh's...
Terry Nichols.
That interview starts
James Nichols.
Oh, Terry Nichols is his brother.
Right.
Who was Timothy McVeigh's accomplice.
They both went to jail, but James did not.
James, it just sounds like almost on a technicality, he didn't get lumped in with them. They just didn't have the evidence on him. But it's pretty evident throughout that interview that whether he took part in the bombing or not, he agrees with them. To put it lightly, he really believes that America's falling apart and violence is the only answer. And he shows more this loaded gun that he has under his pillow. You can see his eyes getting wild as the interview goes on.
Delusions of grandeur as well. And he probably should be at least on a watch list. He calls himself a radical, and he is a radical. They, meaning the Nichols brothers, and also Timothy McVeigh, according to Moore, are from Michigan. And of course, Moore set so many movies, at least part of those movies, even if they're not about this at all, in Michigan, but specifically Flint so often. So the principal that cries on camera, he should probably have not done that. I don't know if he literally pushed in, but just cut the camera, Mike. But then he wants his moment. That's part of the problem with Michael Moore. He does a thing we've seen in a lot of other documentaries and TV shows and news shows where it's somebody starting to cry. Let's not go away from it. The whole big thing in broadcast news, William Hurt faking
tears.
Makes
great TV. Can't deny it. It may be insensitive, but...
It's a touching moment for sure. But he does focus on Michigan so often. We mentioned the Michigan militia. And then, of course, because Michigan's so close to Canada... He first talks about going over the border to Windsor, and then, of course, he ends up in Toronto at one point. Apparently, according to him, in Littleton, which is right near where the Columbine Massacre was, or part of it, something like that, anyway.
Columbine is in Littleton, okay, the high school Columbine.
Yeah. Lockheed Martin's headquarters are nearby, and his implication is that, well, if you've got all these missile heads being driven by these kids on their streets...
Their parents all work to create these weapons of mass destruction.
That are going to kill people. You could say it's for our defense. Okay, fine. It reminds me of the... Okay, they're a little political here. Rittenhouse thing. My life is threatened. I was attacked. Okay, I don't believe the guy for one thing, obviously, and I'm sure you don't either. But let's just give him the benefit of the doubt and say he says life was threatened. How do you not feel fucked up from that forever when you kill people, even if they deserved it? If somebody breaks in here when I'm up late at night and you're in bed with the dogs thinking that either nobody's here or nobody's awake, and we don't have a gun, but I use a baseball bat and bash their brains in or stab them with one of our big knives. You think I'm going to feel good about that? But this Rittenhouse guy seems to feel good about it. The conservative people took him to that recent conference and he's a hero, standing ovation. That is so fucked up. Well, I did the right thing. Even if you did, you don't feel bad about that forever. If you killed somebody who was coming at you with a gun and you killed them, there's not that party that has PTSD about it, really?
Something that's interesting about all the arguments that Moore makes in this movie is that Moore doesn't blame guns for the violence because he points out very accurately that lots and lots of Canadians have guns, but we don't suffer the gun violence, even a shred of what America does.
One thing we don't really have, though, machine guns, the AR-15 either.
That's true.
Giant weapons of war.
Sure, sure, sure. And it's not to say that there wouldn't be less violence if there were fewer guns, but lots of countries have guns and don't have the level of violence that America has. So what makes America different? Of course, he presents all kinds of arguments, never really draws a conclusion that I find remotely satisfying, for the record. And then in 20 years of seeing this violence get worse and worse, I think we've seen a clear picture. And a big part of that clear picture is...
Media.
The media, this attitude, this fear-mongering that goes on.
Racism. Black man arrested today. Black man in your neighborhood. Black man raped somebody. Black man is coming from your kids. The media's been doing that for a very long time. That's one of the things about this movie that he got so accurately that I don't know if I fully agree with or believe when I saw this movie the first time.
It was a new concept to me when this movie came out. Back in 2002, I may have been vaguely aware of this notion that black people were really badly misrepresented in TV and movies. But until I saw it in Bowling for Columbine, I don't think I really put together just how pervasive the images are and just how much that really does prey on your mind. And it actually did radicalize my thinking when it comes to that.
Well, I'm about to go in a couple of hours to a station for my last time this week, and I've talked about the CBC many times. I've worked there for going on 24 years.
Yeah, this movie actually really illustrates Canadian media, so you have a take
on it. It is different.
Sure.
It's absolutely more calm. When Trump spoke as president or even as a candidate, we didn't air every fucking thing that Pete... Okay, sorry. We didn't air everything he ever said in the history of the world. Like CNN and certainly Fox and ABC and NBC and CBS did.
He's not our president, so.
Granted, that's part of the reason why. And then even when he was president, he wasn't the lead story every single fucking night. But I also remember when the bastion of news in this country for decades, Peter Mansbridge, was still working for the CBC as the national anchor.
He's like the Canadian, what, Cronkite?
Probably, yeah. I would say so. And I respected his talent. He was a good journalist. But anyway, he did a thing where they sent in emails, people did, and they said to him, one person asked, What about this thing about if it bleeds, it leads? Well, you know, Jimmy, bleeds, it leads. No, that's not true. And I remember thinking then, and this is quite a long time ago, because he's been retired for a while, and that was long before he retired. That doesn't happen. Are you fucking kidding me? Even the Canadian media is guilty of this, and the American media is so guilty of this. The whole thing a minute ago we said about racism in the news, absolutely true. But if something bad has happened in your neighborhood, yeah, you need to know if there's some rapist on the loose or some pedophile on the loose in your neighborhood. That's important. But the American media will make that seem like that's the only thing that's ever happened or could happen or will happen. And you need to know. And you better stay tuned, because if you don't stay tuned, then we don't get to sell stuff and make more money. Because that's what this always comes down to with
them. Something Canadian media is just as guilty of. I have a friend who worked in the promo department at the 24-hour news station, and we work for competing television stations. And I always joked with her about how many times can you write Salmonella in your food and how it might affect your family.
Tune in
at 11.
Right.
Like, they won't just tell, like, if you really wanted to protect the public, you would be like, don't eat romaine lettuce. Mm. Stay tuned for 11 for more details. Please don't eat the romaine lettuce. But they really want to scare people.
A cliffhanger.
It gets people to tune in. Or, are school buses safe? Tune in at 11. As soon as news became something for profit instead of public good, the TV stations did, aside from all their regular programming,
that is
really when the real problems began. Although, even as we say this is not something that Michael Moore says in the movie. This is something that we've gotten from other documentaries we've seen about the same subject. Things like Manufacturing Consent or Outfox dug deeper into what I think is probably closest to the real problem in America. Not to mention lots of social problems in America that probably lead to violence. There's just way more division in class. The separation between the rich and the poor. The fact that people can't make ends meet. Something he also addresses. The mother of the child who brought the gun to school, who killed the little girl. He was a completely unsupervised child because this is the wealthiest country in the world that doesn't have the resources, has the resources, just doesn't have the empathy, the humanity to let a woman collect welfare to raise her child.
So welfare to work.
Welfare to work.
And traveling
and how this
for hours.
Destroyed this family. Oh, so that rich companies could get cheap labor. Everything about it is so twisted and crazy when you see it in practice, and cruel when you see it in practice. And it's all those problems that I think are way more contributing to violence in America than even gun availability, which is its own problem. Listen, I am very pro-gun control, but I don't think it's the beginning and end of the story at all.
And most companies are guilty in some way of taking advantage of very cheap labor. Chris and I recently talked about McFarland, which is not a political movie. We were probably more political in the podcast than the movie itself is. But there's this underlying thing, not really underlying, but this element in the movie of these young Hispanic kids who have to work hard before school and then go back and pick fruit and other produce after school. And this they tip your games thing that South Park parodied so well on their show. These people are desperate. They're getting no money for doing this really anyway. They're barely getting by. And they didn't hire themselves. The black woman in the welfare to work program whose kid killed another kid at school didn't hire herself. Dick Clark did. Now, is Dick Clark the villain in this movie? He's rude to Michael Moore. No doubt about it. But Michael Moore does that all the time. I'm going to bang on somebody's door and then act like I'm surprised that they didn't let me in. So it's a gotcha moment. It's not really fair to Dick Clark.
When you look at what he did to Charlton Heston, Dick Clark was absolutely smart to turn down his interview to just give him the blow off, obviously.
But Michael Moore does that, and it does make people like Clark and Heston look bad, but he can understand why they don't really want to speak to him in that moment. But it's not even Dick Clark's fault, nor is it Heston's fault. This is a system we have that sets up this notion of, well, if you don't want to work here, then I'll find somebody else, which I understand, but a country that was built on the backs of slaves still has, not slaves, but slave labor situations. You're paying people, but it isn't enough to live. We talk about it in Canada too, raising the minimum wage. Living in Toronto, I'm sure this is true about Montreal, Vancouver, probably Calgary, the big cities of our country, that minimum wage is not enough for a family, certainly, but probably even for an individual to live in these cities. We do fine. We've talked about it a lot, so we haven't lived in this house for all that long. It cost us a lot to move here. We haven't even paid all the taxes it cost. That'll come very soon. But just imagine if you're somebody in these situations that doesn't have that money at all. So anyway, the system is such a vicious setup to hurt people. And yes, it ends up being people of color, indigenous, whatever, immigrants, that kind of thing. They get hurt over and over and over again. But it's been set up to screw with all of us unless you're born rich or you somehow made your own way. And that's always a subplot in this movie. A black guy who has done well, though, and one of my favorite comedy bits he's ever done, and of course he's one of the funniest people ever, but Chris Rock. I always remember from this movie, I gotta quote it, I think they should tax the bullets. They should make them $5,000. $5,000. Because if they cost that much, there wouldn't be an innocent bystanders getting shot in drive-by shootings. I would fucking kill your ass if I could afford it. Gonna get me a job, gonna get some bullets on layaway, and you're fucking dead. And I misquoted it, but I got the gist of it, and that's one of the greatest things he's ever written in his entire life.
It's really so funny. So all this makes me reflect on what it's like to watch a Michael Moore movie 20 years later, because it's kind of surreal to go back and watch movies like this. He has an agenda. He'd be the first to admit it.
He's an activist.
He doesn't even call them films. He's called them visual op-eds. He's making propaganda, and he will own that accusation. He wants people to get outraged and active, and that spirit is so evident in his voice and in his films. So to watch this and to watch Roger and Me decades later, knowing that these problems have only gotten worse, and that the powers behind these malignant problems in America have gotten so much stronger. We talk about things like welfare to work and the gap between the rich and the poor so much worse. The desperation is off the charts now. The pandemic has just made everything that much more obvious. Homelessness is as big a pandemic as COVID is.
Yeah.
Back when this film came out, we watched this interview with Nichols, McVeigh's accomplice, and we thought, what a nut. I felt safe watching because he's the outlier and he got stopped. But you watch it now knowing that his philosophy, his paranoia, his total distortion of reality has caught on like a virus. There's a mutated strain of his ideas that have caught hold of America with a choking grip in a way that we never could have imagined in 2002. You could laugh at Nichols. He is not funny anymore. It is absolutely insane how big those ideas and that attitude has become in the last 20 years.
The insurrection of the Capitol is proof of that.
Exactly.
They didn't have guns, but you know they wanted to.
And it is wild to go back in time and to immerse ourselves in the optimism that Moore had. I think he's still driven by optimism. We both listen to his podcast sometimes, and he's just as driven now still. I don't know how he still has faith, but boy, would we all be doomed if Michael Moore gave up. Then you know things are really messy, but it is pretty depressing to go back and watch Roger and Me, and it seems quaint what happened to Flint then. I mean, look at Flint now, and then look at how Flint has happened to cities all across America and the world. Certainly Canada, we've had our share of these problems. It's just not as extreme as America, but I never want to get cocky. We have to remain vigilant too, although I don't know if vigilance helps. It's sad to see somebody who, in my opinion, is so evidently on the right side of history and who got so many people's attention and really felt like he was galvanizing a movement, and now, years later, to just see the evidence of how poorly he's failed over and over and over again.
That was going to be my wrap-up, is that it's an enjoyable movie about a terrible topic. There seem to be school shootings every week in America now.
Oh my God.
That wasn't true in 1999, but now it seems to be so common.
Like, okay, maybe not. Columbine was this insane example of something this terrible could happen. It's hardly a standalone.
It wasn't so true in the last few years because of the pandemic, but still it happened a few times when kids were back in school. And before it, we heard about it so damn often. Sandy Hook obviously is a big one. And as he's lamented about some of his other documentaries, including on the commentary for Roger and Me, he failed.
Yeah.
He wanted to make a difference in a gun-obsessed country with this movie. And it got worse. For 9/11, he wanted Bush to lose the election, and he won. Mm-hmm. We don't know what cheating was going on, but that's the one time Republicans have won an election without it being controversial in a very long time, in many decades.
Mm-hmm.
He failed there. Sicko. Okay, maybe there's a bit of a success there. And I really do like that movie a lot, because universal health care is still not the law of the land for them. And that's one of the biggest differences between them and us, is that generally speaking, I'm sure there are examples where this isn't true. If you get sick in Canada, you are not going to go bankrupt and you're not going to be left to just die. But in the States, that's been true for so long. Obamacare's helped that, but not as much as it should have. And that did come 4 or 5 years after Sicko came out. And Sicko also has some of the most emotional scenes in any movie of his ever. And he's always had emotional scenes. But speaking of emotion, let's talk again about the actual reason for this movie to be made, which is the Columbine Massacre. Klebold and Harris, who did take their own lives, by the way, of course, that day. Usually that's what seems to happen in these shootings. We rarely seem to have somebody that actually lives and then goes on trial and has to answer for their crimes. 13 people died, so not all kids. There were some teachers as well. The scenes with the actual kids, again, one of those moments where Michael Moore puts people on camera, footage somebody else shot, because it was a news camera that shot this, and these girls and boys, mostly girls, I think, talking about what they experienced. None of his voiceover, none of his tricks, just let them do their thing. Very powerful stuff. The 911 calls that are played as well,
oh, yeah.
Very powerful stuff. And then the payoff to that, I think it's fairly soon after those scenes in the movie, because he does jump around a lot, as we always do in our podcasts. But we see Matt Stone of South Park talking about the massacre, because he grew up not too far from there. And then Marilyn Manson. So you got pop culture figures and very controversial ones, especially then. Marilyn Manson, more so in a way, because of what's come out since, the way he's treated, was it Evan Rachel Wood? Is that his girlfriend?
Evan Rachel Wood and
Rose McGowan.
Rose McGowan is also...
Right. So yeah. We won't get into that, because that's not the point of why he's in this movie. I'm not trying to lionize him if he's done these other terrible things. But in this movie, he and Matt Stone too, but especially Manson, make the most sense of anybody on screen in the entire thing, other than, I guess, the kids that are lamenting what happened.
He's the clearest voice of reason in the whole film.
The biggest thing he says is, I would do one thing that no one else did. I'd listen to those kids. Mm. Look what happened with the, what's it called, March for Our Lives. All these kids out there, no, they're just actors, according to people like Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson. Just pretend, even though it was a gigantic, massive protest. I remember saying to you, maybe one of our podcasts, we talked about this, that those kids, especially in Florida, but other states too, you would think they'd be at the table, like that scene in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington early on, where they're pressuring their father to make Jeff Smith be the senator. The father who has influence doesn't even know who that is until they're talking about Jeff Smith, the guy who runs the Boy Rangers, it's got to be him. I was hoping, and maybe this was something that happened, that these kids would be at their table saying to their parents, because they can't vote yet when they're 13 or 15 or 16 years old, Dad and Mom, you're going to vote for the Republican that's pro-gun? Are you? Oh, are you? Are you? Are you? And just badger them to the point where they say, fine, I'll vote for the candidate who's not pro-gun.
We see it with our nephew, who cares more about environmental issues than, I wouldn't say more than anyone else in our family, but I think feels an urgency that we don't necessarily feel. And doesn't pressure us into voting one way or another, but is pretty expressive about his politics that nothing matters more than the environment. And it's really hard to argue with him because he is absolutely right. Now, I'll make this argument, though. Probably a lot of hearts and minds have been changed by things like Michael Moore's activism or the activism of the Parkland survivors or all the people who take part in these things and who passionately speak in favor of change. But the fact is, when you poll Americans, they are much farther left than their leadership would suggest. Overwhelmingly, Americans are pro-gun control. They are pro...
Universal health care.
They are...
Against the insurrection.
Pro-choice. They're against the insurrection. If democracy worked, these changes would have happened. So the problem isn't necessarily that you're not getting through to Americans. It's that Americans don't have the power that they've been told that they have. There's other forces at work, like money in politics.
Which is far
like
worse now.
Like corruption in politics.
And after this movie came out, quite a few years
later. And just the sheer power of the corporation, too.
About 10 years later, this movie comes out, and then corporations are people. Supreme Court says that, which means basically anybody can put whatever they want to into campaigns. That's out of control. No matter who wins, that's out of control. And the other thing, of course, is basically striking down voting rights. So anyway, I wanted to ask you, though, about Matt Stone and Marilyn Manson. I assume you thought those scenes were good, too?
Oh, yeah, they're incredible. Marilyn Manson, the accusations against him notwithstanding, but just as he is in this film, he is somebody that was really painted to be a villain, and then for him to be so...
Rational. Full makeup, too, in Marilyn Manson makeup.
Rational and calm and smart and clear and correct. He's not even trying to defend himself. He doesn't care. Obviously, he's the type of person who's painted his own target on himself, doesn't mind the attention. It probably sold more records than anything else he ever did. So I don't think he has a problem with that. But maybe because he has this remove that he doesn't care, he can see it for what it is more so. The same with Matt Stone. He's already got a target. He can say whatever he wants. But I found his interview, I guess, a little less insightful.
He's a little dismissive, too, because... One of the things you'd probably have if those two guys sat down again and talked about this exact same issue 20 years after this movie came out and more than 20 years after the event, they'd probably both be more sensitive to mental health because Klebold and Harris must have had mental health issues to have done this in the first place. And Stone does the, come on, it's going to get better later on. He does the Dan Savage thing. It will get better, not about being gay, although they're accused of being gay. But neither, it's more so Stone, I guess, would just throw off this notion that, just grow up and move on from this. If you're going through something like that, then it's not enough to just say, move on from it, because obviously these guys needed help.
But it's not high school that made them do it. Evidence has shown there's been so many mass shootings in America in the last two decades. It's not all kids. There are older shooters as well.
Well, you play into what I'm saying, the mental health problem.
Is it a mental health problem? Is it just that he was a psychopath? That's not a mental health problem that's going to be solved because therapy becomes more affordable.
Why does America have so many psychopaths then?
every country has lots of psychopaths. What makes a psychopath violent? And then what gives them the opportunity and the motive to carry out that violence?
Apparently, according to what you've told me a few times in the more recent years, is that it's not really video games, even though that's, of course, accused of being the problem in this. Because when kids actually play violent video games, generally, that makes them less physically violent.
It could just be like a pop culture study. Sometimes science reporting is one of the worst parts of the media, is the way that media reports on science. It can be really frustrating because you can't believe anything that you hear. But Michael Moore makes a perfect argument in the movie where he says, well, every country has video games. Japan has violent video games, and they have one of the lowest murder rates in the world, and certainly of gun violence. If it was video games, the problem would be everywhere. If it was Marilyn Manson, the problem would be everywhere. If it was violent history, the problem would be everywhere. I'm sorry, these arguments are so easy to dispute. Then I guess the problem with this film becomes that he never really draws anything remotely close to a conclusion.
Which is what documentaries are supposed to do.
Okay, but I don't think this movie even paints a picture where we could draw our own conclusion. I think it just muddies the water. It doesn't clarify the situation. It kind of gives you ideas you may not have had before about various social problems, but it doesn't circle back and teach you why it has anything to do with the American violence that he's trying to address in this film. I don't think he knows. Who does know?
Well, who does, exactly. Even the experts don't seem to know exactly what it is. It's going to be different for different individuals that shoot up schools or shoot up a hospital or shoot up a house, kill their wife. Sometimes you can go A to B and know why they did it. Other times you're just never going to be able to find out for sure. One of the more effective things in the whole movie, though, and it did seem like it was attached to Stone and Parker, and Matt Stone apparently was pissed about this, and I guess Parker was too, is the funny cartoon that does seem South Park-esque, but it wasn't made by them, that slavery in the Civil War, Ku Klux Klan, NRA, and this whole thing about how black people are freed and now they want revenge. In a pretty succinct minute or two, it's a very effective cartoon, and I think it's pretty funny as well. I also think in a lot of ways it gets to the core of the problem here. That people think we better arm ourselves because they are starting to outnumber us and they're going to come to get us. Even though generally speaking, look at the Black Lives Matter movement. It isn't about revenge. Of course there are going to be black people that want revenge for things that have happened to them or their family or people they don't even know, like a George Floyd. But most of them just want to fucking live. Yeah. It's as simple as that. The whole point of that is stop killing us. I was thinking about this just yesterday. Maybe it would have helped and would have stopped this All Lives Matter stuff if they had said Black Lives Matter too.
They read as only Black Lives Matter, whereas the message is Black Lives also matter.
That would have also been fine.
Yeah.
So anyway, do you agree with me that the montage, the cartoon sequence, is pretty effective for that element of the movie, which has got to be an underlying element of all of what we just talked about?
I like that montage. I just don't know how much it belongs in this movie. Making racists look like cartoon characters doesn't really help anybody because nobody sees themselves in this. Even racist people don't see themselves in that because they're not literally putting hoods on and lynching people.
They want to, though. The lynching part, at least.
Okay, but you're still talking about a pretty small part of the population. I think the problem is when Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson go on TV and imply that the Black Lives Matter protests aren't peaceful and that actually these people are tearing apart the very fabric of America. And that's what spawns the paranoia that makes everybody want to have an arsenal in their house.
And in the end, of course, this is going to mean less money for rich people if there's ever real justice in every country, but especially America. And that's the ultimate sin. You can't possibly take away my money.
It's something that this film doesn't address, and I feel like the whole gun safety movement fails to address is the fact that gun manufacturers have become gigantic in the last few decades. They have gone from being like a pretty healthy, hardy industry to being a mega industry that makes billions. And then every time there's a shooting like Columbine or Parkland or Sandy Hook, gun sales go up and their stock price goes up and they get richer and they have lobbyists. And the NRA is basically a lobby group working for Smith & Wesson and Glock and all these companies that we'll talk about how oil companies get rich, but we'll never talk about how gun and ammunition manufacturers are also a huge industry. I'm surprised that he doesn't get into it in this film because it feels like it's right there.
Well, especially considering every time there's been a school shooting or any kind of major shooting, the thing that happened in Vegas wasn't a school shooting. That was just people out partying. Mm. Or there's some kind of nightclub. I think that was in Florida,
wasn't it? It was a music festival. Oh, the Pulse nightclub. Vegas, it was a music festival, it was an outdoor concert.
So we're not just talking about school shootings, but when these things happen, it's always the same answer from the Mitch McConnell people. We can't talk about this so soon after a tragedy. Okay, so months go by, can we talk about it now? No. So it's never going to be solved, and that's been proven over and over and over again because of things like lobbying, and because a lot of people in Congress and the Senate are also big fans of guns. They are probably benefiting financially, undoubtedly that's part of it, but they also love guns themselves. This is a bipartisan issue. Republicans are worse, but it's not like most Democrats stand up and say, okay, maybe the squad, those types of people, sure, but they're new. Generally speaking, Democrats say, we love guns too. Second Amendment's very important to us also. It's just, stop killing kids, rather than, well, we can't do anything about this. What can we do? Some guy's got a thing in his shoe and wants to blow up a plane. We'll take off our shoes for 20 years and counting, or probably more than 20 years and counting. But when it comes to kids getting killed, we do nothing about that whatsoever.
The bedrock of America is cognitive dissonance. And listen, that's probably true in many ways about Canada too, and just every government all over the world. It's disheartening, and it's contributed to my cynicism. Mm-hmm. When this movie came out, I was 24 years old, and I believed the world was going to get better. I really believed that things like this movie and The Daily Show and just the way it felt like culture at large was so actively, aggressively trying to make the world a better place and trying to call out wrongdoing and evil. And every documentary I saw that would point out a new aspect and shine the light on corruption, that it was going to fix things. Enron, we talk about Enron, the smartest guys in the room. That is an outlier because there were consequences suffered for ruining thousands of lives and taking the stock market down with you. That just doesn't happen anymore. It's so predictable that we would talk about a Michael Moore film and talk way more about politics than we are about the actual film.
Well, the movie's political. That's a big part of the reason why we're talking about this. And also, we're at the point now.
He would like this. He would prefer this, I think.
Yeah.
Than to talk starting about a real conversation. The cinematic this and that of the film.
Who knows where the world will be or Canada will be by the time we post this podcast in less than 2 weeks. But we're basically in lockdown again because people can't get a little needle in their arm. I don't want that. Infringing my freedom. Can't wear a mask. Yeah, and that's why we're again dealing with this.
Or because wealthier countries are hoarding the vaccine as well.
Also a scandal.
And there are people who are financially benefiting from vaccine hesitancy.
And this is why we get cynical about things like this. If nothing ever made me cynical, and of course I was long before the pandemic put it really over the edge, because we can't even agree on that. Okay, we talked about Michael Moore's other movies. We've covered Roger and Me. We've covered Fahrenheit 9/11 long ago in our archives. I think Sicko is my favorite of all his movies, so maybe we'll cover that one of these days. I love the sequence in that movie where the guy who says later on, I'm a member of the Conservative Party, but talking about how, well, why is Michael Moore is obviously doing this as a shooting fish in the barrel. Why does the regular citizen have to pay for your health care? Take care of yourself. The guy says, we'd want everyone to be taken care of.
We would take care of our neighbor or something.
And that's when it comes out that, oh, you must be part of the Green Party or the Liberals. Actually, no, I'm a member of the Conservative Party. I've watched that scene and broken down and almost cried. That's the way that guy feels. Maybe he doesn't anymore.
He's Canadian. You never mentioned this. So he's the Canadian.
Well, it's a big part of it. That's our Canadian system, yes, because we take care of people, generally speaking.
When you give people health care, almost everybody, including conservatives, discover that it actually is an incredible public good.
Yeah, and it comes out of our taxes, but it is well worth it. Okay, anyway, the movie's 185:1. We watched it on Prime, even though we have the DVD. But it's grainy and also had some sync issues a few times. We almost stopped watching it that way and threw in the DVD, but they didn't continue. So maybe that's the way it is on the DVD, too. I don't remember. But I don't know what's going on with Prime's print. It looks pretty bad and sometimes sounds pretty bad. The editor, Kurt Engfair. This was his debut as an editor. He also did cut Fahrenheit 9/11, and now he's directing his own documentaries. And the composer, Jeff Gibbs, worked on Fahrenheit 9/11 and Capitalism, A Love Story, and has also been a producer on Michael Moore's documentaries. There's not that much to say about the music, I don't think. We talked about the editing at the beginning of the podcast. Documentaries aren't really meant to look good. Your thoughts?
For a documentary that had one of the biggest budgets in documentary history, you're right. It doesn't really look that great.
And it is muddy. Muddy in the sense of what it's trying to say.
There's a great movie in there, and I don't think he found it. I think he really needed to learn how to kill his darling. Something that he did a little better as it went on. Sicko is probably his best made film with the most coherent vision. So he does get better at this as things go on. The movie just has way too much ideas smashed in there.
I did like this movie more when I didn't know about some of these things or feel the way I do now, 20 years ago, funnily enough, because I feel so strongly about these issues. But I look at the movie and think, it's there, but it's not finished. It's not quite there.
While that's a complaint about the cinema of it, and I think it's a really fair criticism, I just really wanted to, again, take the opportunity to give Michael Moore his flowers for changing the way activism works, changing the hearts and minds of a lot of people, and introducing a tactic to the left that the right has never been able to capitalize in the same way because they're all a bunch of humorless
funny friends. Activism.
Yeah. Being funny, accessing your audience where they are, giving the spoonful of sugar with the medicine, and then helping to create a real difference. I know we talked about how he failed, but I really have to wonder what the world would look like without Michael Moore and all of the people he influenced, which is, I think, immeasurable. He has tried every possible way to get his message across over the years, but always with this irreverence. I think that he brings a tremendous amount of humanity to his work.
I think that's true, too, even though I think there's a bit of
a lot of people hate him.
Because he wants to upset the system and take away their money.
Yeah, because
he's a wealthy man, too.
Make people uncomfortable. He did not make this movie because he wanted to get rich.
No. What happens next? Well, America just keeps worshiping guns. Calling it worship might even be a massive understatement. I think at this point they prefer bullets to Jesus, and that's saying something. And I already did my wrap-up, so your last thoughts on Bowling for Columbine. My wrap-up, just to highlight again, is the notion that he's tried so hard in his movies to make a difference, and he's admitted it. Basically, he's almost always failed.
This film is still so great to revisit, but it's also still very entertaining.
It is.
And interesting to watch from an outsider's perspective now, 20 years later.
He's the court jester who actually should be listened to by the king and queen, if you will. Well, we talked about the effects of bullets entering the human body today. In 7 days, we'll see what happens when little kids are the ones wielding guns in City of God or Ciudad de Dios. The coming attractions trivia for City of God. It's 24th or 23rd, depending what day you look, on the IMDb's top 250. Only one other film that's primarily in a language other than English ranked higher. So which one is it?
For the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about City of God. For more from us, visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project wherever you listen to us. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. We're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium fair trade coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT for a 20% discount. It's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive.
Well, then on a good note, actually. Across from me, Bev is holding our little foster dog, Jewel, and she's laying
wonderful dog.
And her beautiful little face on the table.
Her little chin.
Her eyes are half closed. It's so cute.
She's pooped because she's
now the eyes are
today.
Open.
Oh, she knows we're talking about her.
But yes, that's on a good note, but I'll end on this note. This is the end of this cold, dead podcast.
And cut.